Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, April 28th, 2025 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with the From the Editor column, and then I'll read the cover story, and points of progress will follow. Science and Nature's AWOL again, so I'll read the explainer. Then we'll do the home forum and the monitor's view. So getting right into it, the From the Editor column is entitled Caring for Earth, Cultivating Community. This is written by Noelle Swan, who is the editor of the weekly edition. And you can email her at nswan@csmonitor.com. And she writes, in this week's cover story, Monitor journalists Lindsay McGinnis and Sarah Miller Lana bring readers to Indonesia, where a movement known as Green Islam has taken root in schools, mosques, and other community organizations. With parallels to other theologically based environmental movements, Green Islam uses the teachings of the Quran to promote stewardship of the earth. It is perhaps unsurprising that such an idea would take hold in the world's largest Muslim-majority nation, an archipelago of islands facing numerous challenges spurred by changes in climate. What is surprising is that the principles of Green Islam are being embraced by both non-Muslims and Indonesians who say climate change either doesn't exist or isn't caused by humans. Many residents seem to connect with the idea of caring for the environment as a means to care for each other and the community. For example, many residents who are not Muslim have contributed money to the construction of eco-mosques, not because they intend to worship there or because they are personally interested in reducing any carbon footprint, but because it ends up bringing the community together, says Sarah. The idea of Green Islam as a force for community cohesion took on a particularly profound note for both Lindsay and Sarah after they spent time with Octavia Shinta Aryani as the leader of a local interfaith environmental group in Pontianak, a city on the island of Borneo. Ms. Shinta brings together people of different faiths to compare theological texts on how best to care for the earth. We expected her to be this big environmentalist, and she wasn't, says Lindsay. Her group is first and foremost about fostering peace in her city, which is totally driven by her experiences of having seen ethnic conflict. I'll let you read the story to learn the details of Ms. Shinta's journey, but in short, a glimpse of sectarian mob violence as a teenager inspired her lifelong mission to promote peaceful coexistence in one of the most ethnically diverse countries in the world. Her family wasn't from the ethnic group being targeted by the mob she witnessed, so the conflict wasn't involving her people, so to speak, Lindsay says. But still, they were her people. She loved this community, and it was her home. And so that experience drove everything she's done since. And that was the From the Editor column written by Noelle Swan, who's the editor of the weekly edition. And this week it was entitled, Caring for Earth, Cultivating Community. And now for the cover story, it's entitled Indonesia's Green Islam Movement. Citing the Quran and emphasizing religious duty, Indonesian Muslims are promoting better stewardship of the earth. And this is written by Lindsay McGinnis and Sarah Miller Lana, who are staff writers. And they do have that paragraph here, why we wrote this. It's got the heading of responsibility. Indonesia, which has the world's largest Muslim population, is vulnerable to climate change. A national movement called Green Islam is urging all citizens to care for the earth. From Jakarta and Pontianak, Indonesia, the school bell, a gong, is struck at 3 p.m. as a thunderstorm rumbles and the call to Asr, the late afternoon Muslim prayer, wafts through the air. High schoolers at Darul Ulum Lido, an Islamic boarding school outside the capital, Jakarta, filter out of their classrooms, grab their mats, and head to the small, bright green mosque at the edge of campus. Daily prayer is part of the rhythms of the 300 or so Muslim students here, both boys and girls. They study Arabic grammar, math, and science, as well as the Quran and Islamic law. But one of the school's signature subjects includes lessons on how Muslims should be good stewards of the earth. After the afternoon prayers, the thunderstorm fading into the distance, the group of girls takes a winding cobblestone path through a thin area of woods and approaches a greenhouse. The girls pass under a banner displaying a verse from the Quran, an instruction to harvest the fruit of a garden in season, but without waste. At the nursery, ninth grader Zilda Nafisa takes in the scent of wet soil and fresh herbs. She reaches up to check the leaves of a bok choy plant growing from a plastic hydroponic tube. It can take up to 40 days for bok choy to grow, she explains, under the icy glow of chlorophyll-stimulating LED lights. Plants that aren't used in the kitchen will be fed to the school's flock of chatty brown ducks. Zilda has been part of the girls' greenhouse club for 2 years. It reminds her of her parents' garden back home, she says. She likes tending to these plants that provide the community with food, as well as with oxygen. Being aware of the environment is important for a Muslim, she says. That connection is something that her teacher, Faizan Zuri, a Muslim scholar, is intentionally fostering in his course on environmentalism in the Quran. He says the ancient tome contains many teachings that instruct people to care for the earth, but Muslims didn't necessarily perceive these parts of scripture as environmental messages, he says, before the climate crisis. Now, Jakarta is sinking. Floods and wildfires happen with devastating frequency in this climate-vulnerable nation spanning some 17,000 islands. Today, those teachings are becoming clear, Mr. Zuri says. The lessons are everywhere. Darul Ulum Lido is what is now called an eco-boarding school, part of a program established 4 years ago as part of a Green Islam movement that teaches Muslims around the world to lead the way on caring for Earth's climate. Here in Indonesia, the world's largest Muslim-majority nation and one of the most ethnically diverse places on the planet, Green Islam has a potential to be a mobilizing force, inspiring calls for climate solutions in schools, mosques, and other grassroots groups. The movement does not rely on the authority of climate science, however. It is a moral message rooted in the Quran, conveyed through faith leaders, and reinforced by the nation's founding philosophy that calls for tolerance and social justice for all Indonesians, regardless of faith tradition. Green Islam is a huge opportunity for Indonesia. It can work to solve many of our problems, says Henning Parlan, who runs an ecological peace-building program at Persyarikatan Muhammadiyah, a wide-ranging reformist Muslim organization in Indonesia. Green Islam is driven by the Muslim community, but the benefit is not only for all Islamic, for the Islamic community, but the benefit of all. Indonesia's mounting climate crises have been profound. Part of the capital are sinking into the ocean by 6 to 10 inches a year, according to reports from the World Bank. This pace is driven mainly by unsustainable groundwater extraction, experts say, though it's also exacerbated by rising sea levels. In response, the government has decided to relocate the capital from Jakarta in northern Java to Nusantara, a future city currently under construction in the forests of Kalimantan on the island of Borneo. But in Borneo, as well as in the western island of Sumatra, a global demand for palm oil, which is used in everything from cereal to deodorant, continues to transform the landscape. Over the past two decades, Indonesia has lost 30.8 million hectares, or about 76 million acres, of tree cover, an area roughly the size of Italy. Slash-and-burn methods of land clearing have sparked wildfires that can rage for weeks. They put at risk not only rural communities, but also orangutans and other endangered species, all while the destruction of peatlands and old-growth forests pumps greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. State-backed nickel mining is exacerbating these problems. Indonesia is by far the world's largest producer of nickel, a critical element for electric vehicle batteries and other renewable energy technology. Ironically, as demand for the green technologies grows, nickel extraction is wreaking havoc on forests and oceans, climate groups say. Yet in a 2020 YouGov poll across 25 countries, Indonesia came in first in climate skepticism, with 1 out of 5 respondents saying climate change doesn't exist or isn't caused by humans. The United States was the second most skeptical. Indonesia's Green Islam movement, from eco-boarding schools to eco-mosques to training for clerics and grassroots groups, is one response to that skepticism. People may not be aware that what is happening is climate change, says Fakhruddin Mangunjaya, a dean in the Faculty of Biology and chairman of the Center for Islamic Studies at the National University in Jakarta. There is no single cure for the environmental crisis, but religion is one variable. We are delivering a strong moral message. Indeed, in Indonesia, people trust religious leaders more than any other leaders, according to a 2024 survey by the global advocacy group Purpose. People listen to religion. They understand religious words and the notion of duty, says Hayu Prabowo, chairman of the Environment and Natural Resources Body of the Ulama Council, the country's highest Islamic authority. Islam says to do a good job for the earth, and the earth will do good for you. The Ulama Council has issued 7 fatwas, or religious rulings, on climate change in the past decade. These include instructions on wildlife protection and efficient waste management. In 2023, the council also issued a fatwa urging Muslims to carry a mandate and responsibility for maintaining and prospering the earth and everything in it as a reflection of Islam. Jakarta's Istiqlal Mosque, the largest in Southeast Asia, has also embraced this mission, becoming in 2022 the first place of worship to be green certified by the World Bank. Inaugurated in 1978, the enormous mosque, its name meaning Mosque of the Independence, was designed to rely on natural light and cross-ventilation. The air conditioning system only kicks in on Fridays when up to 40,000 people gather for a Jummah prayers. Yet it too is powered in part by new solar panels that cover 40% of the building's rooftop. The mosque aims to add more. Slow flow faucets reduce water usage, and stickers with Quranic verses are placed near light switches to remind people to turn them off. Al-Isr 17:27, "Those who waste are kin of Satan," reads one in a basement. Our mission is to be a pioneer and inspire other mosques in Indonesia, says Her Pramtama, an architect responsible for the Istiqlal Mosque property. As mothers fan their children and men sit in groups scrolling on phones one quiet Sunday afternoon, Mr. Pramtama is standing among the mosque's solar panels. He acknowledges that most of the worshipers inside don't understand the importance of what they are doing. This is our homework, to teach people about energy efficiency. Dr. Mangunjaya at the Center for Islamic Studies says he believes educating youth is the fastest way to change hearts and minds. That is why he helped design the eco-boarding school model, or eco-pesantren, which includes schools like Darul Ulum, Lido, and almost 50 others in conjunction with the government in 2021. He wants to see this effort expanded throughout Indonesia as well as in global Muslim communities. He and other Muslim leaders also believe green Islam can do more than help people care for an environment in danger. Some hope it can help foster unity in one of the most diverse countries in the world. Indonesia comprises thousands of islands, hundreds of ethnic groups, and over 700 spoken languages, more than any other nation except Papua New Guinea. But these communities haven't always lived in harmony. Octavia Shinta Aryani was a teenager visiting her older brother in Bengkayang Regency, an area in West Kalimantan on the island of Borneo, when she heard a mob gathering outside. Despite herself, she peeked out the ground floor window and saw an image that would steer the course of her life. A man, his face jubilant and vengeful, was parading a human head through town before dropping it in front of the police station. The man leading the mob was a member of the Dayak, an indigenous people on Borneo who are now majority Christian. The head the man was carrying belonged to a Muslim from the nearby island of Madura. The beheading was the latest in a series of attacks between Dayaks and Mehdi's that began in the late 1990s. The conflict at its core had little to do with religion, but the clashes quickly divided the community along ethnic and religious lines and left hundreds of dead over the past two decades. That experience was years ago, but Ms. Shinta tugs at her fingers as she recalls being frozen at that window, feeling devastated by what had become of West Kalimantan. "Kalimantan is relatively empty," wrote Elizabeth Pisani in her book Indonesia, Etc., Exploring the Improbable Nation, "but it manages to be racially complex. Its thick forests have always been home to Dayak tribes who traditionally lived in longhouses along rivers that cut through the island of Borneo. Malay Muslims, originally from Sumatra and the Malay Peninsula, settled along its coasts. In the 18th century, a Chinese community also settled as an independent state in the west. Then, Indonesians from more populated islands were relocated to larger, less populated islands, as part of the Indonesian government's transmigrant programs in the 1960s. Thousands more people came to the region from Java and Madura. Today, West Kalimantan's riverside capital of Pontianak speaks to that old multicultural mix. It has a vibrant Chinatown, numerous mosques, and a grand Catholic cathedral that blends European and Dayak architectural motifs. It's still a fragile coexistence, Ms. Shinta always fears that hostilities remain just below the surface. Even today, if there's a car crash, the first question is, what group is the driver from? This fragility has driven a lifelong search for tolerance, a tolerance described in Indonesia's founding philosophy called Pancasila, roughly translated as five principles in Sanskrit. Pancasila has roots tracing back thousands of years. The words Bhinneka Tunggal Ika, or unity in diversity, in old Javanese, were first found in a 14th century poem, and today they serve as Indonesia's national motto. They form the core of the official policy of Pancasila, and stated in 1945 by the nation's first president, the revolutionary and Indonesian nationalist Sukarno. He led the fight against Dutch colonists and served as president from 1945 to 1967. Blending Islamic and secular visions for the new nation, the five pillars are a belief in God, civilized humanity, national unity, democracy, and social justice for all. The artist Indra Soroyangjino tells stories of such ideals. The Java-based puppeteer travels the country with a traditional handmade banner on which he has painted the entire history of Pancasila. On a recent day, he unfurls this banner of narrative art. A local gamelan troupe, a percussive musical tradition of Javanese, Sudanese, and Balinese peoples, featuring drums, gongs, and bamboo flutes, plays behind him as he begins to tell the story. "Pancasila is not something easy," says Mr. Seringino. "It is a challenge." In practice, the language of Pancasila has been exploited by authoritarian leaders throughout the country's history, and the government's interpretation only allows for certain kinds of religious diversity. Indonesians must list one of six officially recognized religions on their official IDs. There are no options for atheism or traditional folk religions, even though millions of Indonesians incorporate such beliefs into their religious life. Still, when it comes to Indonesia's environmental crisis, Pancasila could be the solution, says Mr. Suryongino, but politics often get in the way. On paper, the government supports the Green Islam narrative. Nasiruddin Umar, the Grand Imam of the Istiqlal Mosque and the current Minister of Religious Affairs, announced in March that one of his ministry's top priorities is eco-theology, a religious underpinning for environment conservation that could put Indonesia at the cutting edge of such efforts. Last year, however, the government granted mining concessions to religious organizations that have mining interests, including the country's largest and most influential Muslim groups, Nahdlatul Ulama and Muhammadiyya. Both are deeply enmeshed in state affairs, and the concessions have driven a wedge in the Islamic environmental movement. Mrs. Parlan, the environmental activist from Muhammadiyya, sees this move as a contradiction of the Green Islam movement, but she feels she must accept it because she's a member of the organization. I want to use this as an opportunity for the community to learn about the impacts of mining and to strengthen their advocacy against it, says Ms. Parlan, who is also the head of Indonesia's chapter of Green Faith, a global, multi-faith effort to promote a sacred duty to protect the earth. One way she's doing this is through what Muhammadiyya calls Eco Bineka, a program that takes its name from Indonesia's national motto. The program brings together women and young people from various religious backgrounds to promote conservation. It's active in four regions of Indonesia, including West Kalimantan, which faces some of the fastest forest loss amid illegal logging and ever-expanding oil palm extraction. This part of Borneo has lost a third of forest coverage in a generation. This environmental destruction threatens to reignite societal tensions, says Ms. Shinta, who heads the Pontianak chapter of Eco Bineka. So she's seizing an opportunity with Green Islam. My first goal is for my city to be a peaceful one, one that is not easily provoked by a minor incident, says Ms. Shinta. Bringing youth together in the name of peace building alone would be a non-starter. But environmental issues are top of mind for young people and affect everyone regardless of faith or ethnicity. If it's just an interfaith group, they are suspicious, she explains at the elementary school where she sets the curriculum. Fighting climate change has become a unifying force. It's a safe issue. Later that evening, Ms. Shinta presides over a dinner with members of Eco Bineka in Pontianak. About 20 university students and recent graduates sit cross-legged on rattan mats spread out over a long, low table. She waits until evening call to prayer ends, a call aired from mosques in cities and small towns across Indonesia. She then explains that because Ramadan is about to begin, the subject of their monthly gathering is Eco Speak will be food waste. She asks the group members to share the messages they find in their faith books related to this theme. They pull out Qurans and Christian Bibles. They read from the Buddha's Tipitaka canon and the Sisu and the four books of Confucianism. An occasional bolt of lightning lilacs the sky of torrential rains pounds the thatched roof. The group members give one another full attention. Rupina Jeski Angeli, a Protestant from the Dayak Banata tribe, who works as a cashier, talks about the love of earth she finds in Genesis. Reading from the Bible may not be strictly on topic, but what matters is that she is here. She says she used to think women who wore hijabs like Ms. Shinta across the table from her were fanatics. She once heard an employer call her own people cannibals, but she needed the money, so she swallowed her anger. These kinds of discussions about ethnic and religious hostilities would be too delicate if addressed face-on, Ms. Shinta explains. But members of society can get beyond stereotypes and past hurts and fears by getting to know one another in a shared quest to preserve the environment of Kalimantan, including its dense forests and animals threatened by palm oil production and rising seas. Throughout the evening, several themes keep emerging: balance, moderation, and fairness. I. Kadek Harda Widi, a Balinese Hindu, reads from his laptop three philosophies from the Bhagavad Gita. He tries to get the group to understand the ideas of harmony to God, to nature, and to fellow human beings by citing Pancasila. In fact, Pancasila, sometimes invoked as a nationalist tool, runs as a current through the philosophies at Indonesia's eco-mosques, eco-schools, and eco-groups. Ilak Faikotel Mutia, started a nonprofit organization called Enter Nusantara, which promotes a transition to clean energy. To rally the public towards that goal, she says, it relies on Indonesians' deep connection to the community. It's called Gotong Royong, or the joint bearing the burdens, which is also one of the five pillars of Pancasila. That value, Ms. Mutia says, is behind Indonesia's ranking as the most generous country in the world for 7 straight years by the Charities Aid Foundation. She believes it makes Islam more community-oriented in Indonesia than elsewhere in the Muslim world. Sitting in an eco-mosque in the city of Yogyakarta, which is known as the cultural heart of Indonesia, she explains how the entire community, including non-Muslims, helped finance the building's solar panels. It wasn't environmental zeal that inspired them to donate. It was simply that when the electricity goes out in town, everyone can find a light at the mosque. Eco-boarding schools or eco-mosques are supported not because of the environment, but because Indonesians want to help the community around the building itself, says Ms. Mutia. As a climate activist, she finds that the sense of community embodied by Green Islam is key to her work. She doesn't believe climate change can be addressed from the top down or by government decree or global directive. The solution must come from the community itself, she says. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now for Points of Progress in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. What this is a map of the world with points indicated on it and a paragraph or two or three or four describing the point. Number one is Greenland. More commonly linked with the shrinking of Greenland's ice sheet, an atmospheric river storm actually added mass and delayed summer melting. These rivers in the sky are narrow bands of water vapor that move heat from oceans to colder regions, and with climate change are increasing in intensity and frequency. In 2023, Greenland's ice sheet, the world's second largest body of ice, lost to the ocean nearly 80 gigatons of melted glacial ice. Finnish researchers examined a 49-foot fern cone, a length of densely packed snow turning to ice that can act as a natural record keeper of snow accumulation. Using local weather data and a section of the fern, they determined that a 2022 atmospheric river had pelted Greenland with 11.6 billion tons of snow over 3 days and offset the ice sheet's yearly melting by 8%. Contrary to prevailing opinions, said glaciologist Alan Hubbard, under the right conditions, atmospheric rivers might not be all that bad. That was from Gizmodo. Number two, United States. The collaborative experience of owning their own company raises home health care workers' job satisfaction. A small study found more older Americans are depending on home care workers, but at the same time, studies suggest that poor working conditions in most of the industry exacerbate staffing shortages. In contrast to traditionally run care companies, co-ops are owned and run by the workers and generally have lower turnover. The new study said that the model can lead to more respectful and supportive work environments, as well as higher wages, incentives for workers to remain in their positions. The authors interviewed 23 home care workers and 9 staff members across 5 co-ops. They say more research is needed to evaluate the effect of factors such as agency size, but that the work could ultimately inform industry-wide efforts to attract and retain workers and address the workforce crisis. That was from UCLA Health and JAMA. Number three, Colombia. Colombia recognized 2.7 million acres as exclusive to isolated indigenous groups. In 85% of this first-of-its-kind territory, development and forced human contact are prohibited for the Yuripase people living in the southern department of the Amazonas. According to one nonprofit advocate, the Amazon Conservation Team, neighboring indigenous communities knew about the isolated groups, which are increasingly at risk from mining and organized crime. In 2010, these less isolated neighbors overcame a lack of trust to approach the government for help. The unique recognition also protects the land, home to 600 recorded Amazonian species, and clears a way for future studies to confirm the existence of other indigenous groups. That was from Mangabe, Andes Amazon Fund, those two things. Number 4, Uganda. Drivers will slow down when they are both paid and given a socially acceptable reason to change. About 10 people die on Uganda's roads each day. Motorbike taxis are responsible for nearly two-thirds of accidents in the capital, Kampala, but fines and awareness campaigns on the danger of speeding have had little effect. According to behavioral economist Claude Raisaro, drivers feel pressured to speed to complete more trips, but also to maintain prestige with other drivers. An experiment offered 360 drivers 6,000 Ugandan shillings a day, that's about $1.64, about a third of their daily income, to slow down. For some participants, the contracts were publicly disclosed. The public safe driving contract was twice as effective at reducing speeding as the private one, and it essentially reduced speeding in excess of 80 kilometers, or 50 miles, per hour. Twice as many drivers selected the private contract, demonstrating that visibility can increase the effectiveness of monetary incentives. Helping drivers escape the social pressure of adopting risky behaviors may shift norms, creating lasting improvements in road safety, economic efficiency, and environmental impact, wrote Professor Rosero. And that was from something called The Conversation. And last but not least, we've got number 5, the Philippines. In a win-win for mangrove forests and residents, community education and ecotourism have reduced deforestation and raised incomes. On Sayargao, a Philippine island famous among surfers, the Del Carmen Mangrove Reserve was once the site of illegal wood harvesting and destructive fishing methods, including the use of dynamite. But in 2014, the municipality began encouraging residents to appreciate the forests and to grow the tourist industry. Average family income since 2010 has grown 750% to 17,000 pesos a month, about $297. Volunteers patrol the coast for illegal fishing, and locals have replanted to increase mangrove cover by 14%. Last year, the Philippine government named the reserve its 10th site to follow the Ramsar Convention on Wetlands, an international conservation framework. Globally, mangroves prevent more than $65 billion in property damage from storms and reduce flood risk to some 15 million people a year, according to a 2020 report published in the journal Nature. That was from something called Context. And all that was compiled by Cameron Poo and Troy Aiden Simbajan, who are staff writers. As I mentioned at the top of the show, science and nature is AWOL, so I will read the explainer in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. And it is entitled, More Immigrants Face Deportation. What due process are they owed? This is written by Sarah Matusek and Nate Eigelhart, both are staff writers. And they do have that paragraph here, why we wrote this. Immigrants may not have the same status as citizens, but they do have legal rights in the United States. Boundaries are being tested as the Trump administration claims broad authority to deport alien enemies, that's in quotes, and others. As the Trump administration claims broad authority to summarily deport, in quotes, alien enemies, in quotes, invasion, efforts to control U.S. borders and immigration are running up against concerns for individual rights. For immigrants, one of the most basic rights, the ability to have due process in a court of law, is in question. The tension isn't entirely new. Due process for immigrants has been litigated over more than a century, says Nicole Hollett, director of the Immigrants' Rights Clinic at the University of Chicago Law School. But the Trump administration is using executive powers in a new and unprecedented way. Courts may ultimately decide where the line around protections gets drawn. If you give one branch of government an extraordinary amount of power over a group of people, which is what we've done with non-citizens in the United States, we are relying on that branch of government to use that power judiciously, Professor Hollett says. Meanwhile, the current White House intends to stretch their power to the absolute limit. Now, what follows here is a question and answer piece. Question: what does due process mean? Answer: legal experts say due process boils down to providing notice of accusations and giving people the opportunity to be heard in their own defense. The Constitution's 14th Amendment guards against depriving any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Just as in the Fifth Amendment, lawyers note the use of person, not citizen. Everyone has a right to the kind of basic procedural protections when the government is trying to take something away from you, says Professor Hallett. That said, the level of protection might vary depending on your immigration status. Question: so are migrants or so are immigrants entitled to due process? Answer: yes. In the realm of immigration enforcement, though, the process to which they are entitled is generally dictated by Congress. In criminal matters, non-citizens are afforded the same due process protections as citizens. Relatedly, they have a right to be protected from self-incrimination. Criminal defendants, no matter their immigration status, are also entitled to free counsel. Immigrants don't need to be convicted of a crime to be deported, though. Immigration courts, which decide whether people can stay or must leave, are separate from the federal court system. As immigration judges don't hear criminal cases, non-citizens in that system are not entitled to free counsel. That has led at times to children representing themselves. Defense of immigrants' due process rights has transcended ideological lines. Late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, a conservative, wrote in a 1993 opinion, "It is well established that the Fifth Amendment entitles aliens to due process of law in deportation proceedings." Location adds a layer of complexity. Constitutional rights don't always fully apply at U.S. borders, including ports of entry like airports. Anyone, including U.S. citizens, can be searched in those places in ways that may not be deemed legal elsewhere under the Fourth Amendment. Different immigration pathways also have their own protocols. The State Department can revoke visas, as it currently is doing for certain foreign students tied to campus protests. Generally, it's up to an immigration judge to decide whether a green card holder's lawful permanent resident status should be taken away. But again, there may be exceptions, such as if the government, within the first 5 years, concludes the green card was issued in error. Question: how is immigrant access to due process being challenged now? Answer: a prominent case involves the president's reliance on a rarely used wartime authority to deport immigrants who the government accuses of being terrorists. In a proclamation signed in March, President Donald Trump invoked the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 to direct the detention and removal of suspected members of the Tren de Aragua, a Venezuelan gang the government has called a foreign terrorist organization. The government began deporting immigrants to El Salvador under that authority in March. A federal appeals court upheld a temporary restraining order that bars deportations under the act. The Supreme Court on April 8th said deportations under the act can continue for now, but with access to due process for detainees. Shortly after, federal judges in New York and Texas placed further limits on the deportation effort. The American Civil Liberties Union and Democracy Forward, which are suing the government, says it whisked hundreds of people into planes to El Salvador without providing advance notice, let alone an opportunity to contest their deportation. The proclamation also does not provide any process for immigrants to rebut claims of being gang members, the group's note in the court filing. The Trump administration and its allies offer a different position. White House advisor Stephen Miller wrote on the social platform X recently, "If you illegally invaded our country, the only process you are entitled to is deportation." Immigrant advocates and liberals have expressed outrage, especially as new accounts have emerged disputing suspected gang ties of some of the men sent to El Salvador. For the government to claim people aren't entitled to due process violates the basic principle of what this country was founded on, says Aaron Reichlin Melnick, senior fellow at the American Immigration Council. But former immigration judge Andrew Arthur says it's an open question on how process is due to non-citizens in removal cases under the Alien Enemies Act. And looking at the way that Congress wrote the provision, it's likely not much, Judge Arthur, a resident fellow at the Center for Immigration Studies, adds in an email. Mark Krikorian, a longtime advocate of immigration restrictions and executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies, says he's not opposed to the novel way the Trump administration is invoking wartime powers as war has changed. Still, people do have a right to go to court and say, I'm not a Train Day Aragoa member, and therefore this proclamation doesn't apply to me, says Mr. Krikorian. After all, what if an American citizen got picked up? The government has admitted at least one mistake so far. In a court filing, a Justice Department lawyer said the administration deported a Salvadorian man living in Maryland to El Salvador in March because of an administrative error. The Atlantic reported. An immigration judge had previously granted the man a legal protection against deportation. The government says Kilmar Abrego Garcia is a member of the MS-13 gang, which his lawyer denies. By mid-April, the fight to return him to the U.S. reached the Supreme Court, which ordered the government to facilitate his release from custody in El Salvador. The U.S. said it wasn't required to bring him home, while El Salvador said it wouldn't release him. And a final question, what is expedited removal? And the final answer, expedited removal is a fast-track deportation option the government can use. It allows for an immigrant to be deported without access to an immigration judge unless they speak up about wanting to seek asylum. This rapid deportation option became part of U.S. immigration law in 1996 under President Bill Clinton. The provision, since its start, has allowed for the expedited removal of immigrants in the U.S. within 2 years of their arrival. In practice, however, it has typically been enforced along borders, including for unauthorized immigrants apprehended within 2 weeks of their arrival. Mr. Trump has signaled an expansion of enforcement. A notice published January 24th in the Federal Register by the Department of Homeland Security says it is restoring the scope of expedited removal to the fullest extent authorized by Congress as a way to enhance national security and public safety. So far, it's unclear if there has been an increase in authorities using expedited removal, in part because the government hasn't published monthly enforcement statistics since the inauguration. And now for the Home Forum in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. How do I love thee? Five writers celebrate motherly care, a connection that transcends language, a solid, steady lifeline on speed dial, a tender care that doesn't fade even as the decades pass. In this special Mother's Day collection, five writers who have contributed to the Home Forum honor their mothers and mother figures in the myriad ways they love. Now, you might be wondering why the April 28th issue is celebrating Mother's Day. Well, I have neglected to tell you that this issue covers April 28th and May 5th, which is a Monday, and Mother's Day is the following Sunday, May 11th. Here we go. A call for comfort. It was the middle of the night when the red and blue lights flashed behind me. Two police cars appeared. I wasn't speeding and I hadn't run a light, but my heart pounded anyway. Without thinking, I called the one person I always relied on in moments like this, my mother. She answered on the second ring, her voice thick with sleep. Mom, stay on the line with me, I said. I'm here, go ahead. I set the phone on the passenger seat as the officers approached. I'd been driving home after a late night at the newspaper where I worked, exhausted and not expecting any trouble. But the officers took their time, circling my car, asking unnecessary questions. When they finally let me go, I picked up the phone with shaky hands. They're gone, I said. I heard her exhale. All is well, she reassured me, her voice steady, just like I knew it would be. It wasn't just that night. My mom was always the first one I called with good news, bad news, and no news at all, sometimes multiple times a day. When I was growing up, she instilled in me the belief that I was safe and capable and protected. Though she's no longer here, I can still hear her voice as crystal in my mind. You'll get through this. There's always a way. All things are possible. Even now, her words console me and still hold true. And that was written by Courtney Rudinsky. A Quiet Connection. It was that hushed time between when we cooked dinner and when we sat down to eat. The west-facing windows welcomed warm light into the kitchen, and the cooing of the morning doves filled the silence. We were the Grands. She, my mother's mother, and I, her daughter's daughter. There was a grand gap between us on the couch that could have been bridged by words if we had only known then how to speak each other's mother tongues. In the absence of words, there were sounds. Steel knives striking cutting boards, hot water bubbling over fire, and the range hood blaring as we created the Japanese curry and tempura and gyoza and yakisoba that bears symbols of solace for the woman far from her homeland. We wove in between each other like dancers as she taught me how to maneuver around the kitchen and nourish others, as she did for me. Whatever delicacies she pulled out of her recipe book were always so delicious that I would say she should be on Iron Chef. It was because of our comfortable silence that I learned to coexist, to live, to love beyond words. Because that is what my grandmother did when she moved to the United States without knowing English to raise me, care for me. Perhaps we did come to speak the same language after all. And that was from Elika Sue. Tender words. I struggled with spelling, so much that I came to dread Monday afternoon language arts class through middle school. One particularly dismal November Monday, I misspelled 28 out of the 30 words on our pretest. Mrs. Forshee said she'd never had anyone spell that many words wrong. So my weeks revolved around learning to spell the words correctly by Friday's test. My mom would sit with me every night. My mom is a special education teacher. All day long, her own students ask her questions about their own spelling tests, math equations, and biology worksheets. But she'd still work with me, sometimes for an hour or more, beneath the light in the dining room. Do you hear the rhythm of the word when you spell it out loud? Mountain? M-O-U-N-T-A-I-N. It's like you're climbing over the mountains, up and down. You try. I remember writing out appearances, dressed in my wizard robe before trick-or-treating as Mom supervised in her clown costume, or repeating reminiscent over and over again one snowy Friday morning during a two-hour delay as the plows worked outside. Even then, I recognized her uncommon resolve, the attention she gave to my education, and her forbearance in coaching a frustrated child racking his young mind, trying to understand what letters went where. I never felt like my struggle was a burden. I felt so safe and loved with her patience. I still do. And that was written by Noah Davis. And here's the fourth one. Becoming Beloved. I didn't grow up on Prince Edward Island or have red hair or crave puffed sleeves or speak to strangers in monologue responses about the rhapsodies of spring. But I was able to imagine those things because two women, Lucy Maud Montgomery, the author of Anne of Green Gables, and my mother, who first read Montgomery's novel to me when I was 8 years old. My mother read me many books, but I remember this one so well because of how much I loved Anne's character and for the way my mother's voice brought her to life. Anne's dramatic lines weren't just read, they were performed. Matthew and Merlot's baffled responses to Anne's ceaseless questions weren't merely described, they were delivered, accents and all. What was your favorite part? My mother would ask when we'd finish a chapter, and I'd squeeze her hand and think, this. Last month, my own daughter, almost 8 years old, plucked Anne of Green Gables off the bookshelf, and we've been reading it together, word by delightful word. Every time I finish performing one of Anne's monologues or find again the accent I try to keep consistent for Marilla, I steal a glance at my daughter. I think about how her joy in that moment is near the end of a thread that began far before me, with my mother and the two of us lying side by side in the bed, learning about what it means to be a little girl who is loved. And that was written by Emily Brissy. And the last one here is Circle of Service. My mom's superpower? Her loving presence. When I was a child, my mom worked the second shift as an industrial nurse. Despite her late work hours, she woke every day at 6 a.m. or 6:30 a.m., made me a poached egg and buttered toast, and sat beside me on the piano bench while I practiced scales and sonatinas. After school, Mom drove me to ice skating and swimming lessons. Although I ate dinner with my dad, Mom's love was always palpable, from the Jell-O and tossed salad she prepared for us to the sloppy joes waiting in the skillet. My favorite part? Mom's reheating instructions accompanied by a string of X's and O's, and her signature sign-off, with special love. Today, Mom is 90 years young. Although our roles have changed, I now cook and deliver some of Mom's meals, she still finds a way to look out for me. As I say goodbye after my weekly visits, Mom trails me to the door of her condo, reminds me to drive carefully, and watches until I back my car into the street. Never mind that I have 40 years of driving experience. Never mind that Mom's driveway is short and easy to navigate. Without fail, Mom lingers, waving until I'm out of sight. Today, when I check my phone, there's a voicemail. Just returning your call, sweetheart. Love you. Bye-bye. My heart squeezes. Mom is still here for me, teaching me how to love. And that was written by Stephanie Wass. And finally, we're at the Monitor's View in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. These are articles written by the editorial staff, and there are two of them. And here's the first one. Bigger machine, bigger thinking. The operators of the world's largest particle accelerator have a plan to at last unlock the most stubborn mysteries of physics. They're going even bigger. The European Organization for Nuclear Research, or CERN, wants to build the largest machine on Earth. The Future Circular Collider would have a circumference of 56 miles, cost $30 billion, and finish construction in 2070. It would be three times larger than the accelerator that CERN has now, better able to observe the motion of atoms or their parts. Few breakthroughs. But aside from the logistical hurdles of a larger machine, there's a bigger nagging question. Is it even a good idea? The fact is, physics is in a funk. Quantum mechanics and general relativity theory began to reshape scientists' view of the physical world more than a century ago. A theory of everything seemed near, knitting together the last inconsistencies of science into a single unified theory. It has not turned out that way. Intervening years have brought exquisite calibration and confirmation, but few groundbreaking advances. Physics reinvigorated. CERN's idea is to double down. The answer is out there. We just need to keep pushing. But others are less certain. Maybe blunt force experimentation has its limits. It's a vicious cycle, wrote physicist Sabine Hossenfelder on her blog. Costly experiments result in lack of progress. Lack of progress increases the cost of further experiment. The real question is how physics reinvigorates itself. CERN will have its proposal for a solution by December. Yet a deeper change appears to be percolating within physics, a growing humility. It is seen in Dr. Hossenfelder's call for scientists to step back from their favored theories and think better and more collaboratively. It's also seen in thinkers such as Brian Greene, who said in a recent Templeton Foundation podcast, "It's very difficult to answer these questions, of course, and what you find is, as a working physicist, you don't really have to." Meaning, he added, doesn't come from science, but from the excitement and inspiration that we invest in our different experiences. Emerging from this openness is a recognition that machines matter, but the frontiers of mind perhaps promise more. The origin of the universe, the origin of life, the origin of mind are sort of the big three moments in existence, Dr. Greene noted. I suspect, and I think many scientists agree, that there is a real continuum at work here, and I think that's pretty important. Certainly, a larger particle accelerator might help usher in physics renaissance. Larger thinking could do even more. And the second one is local care for absentee students. What are neighbors for? New York City is about to provide one answer. They're to help children of other neighbors not play hooky. In early April, the largest school system in the United States announced it will enlist 1,600 volunteer parents to contact other parents in their communities whose children, about 300,000 in all, are chronically absent from school. These family connectors are the latest innovation by American educators trying to curb a high rate of student absenteeism that has persisted since the pandemic, and that can be costly. A Stanford University study last year found the learning loss for students not in class during the pandemic is 5% to 6% of their lifetime earnings, or $31 trillion from the nation's gross domestic product. We need to ask the question, parents, what is keeping your children from getting to school and how can we help you? Said Melissa Aviles-Ramos, leader of the Big Apple's public schools. In fact, the fact that the volunteers are local and unpaid and not formally tied to government is a way to tap into neighborly trust. That approach is far different from sending a truancy officer to a home to make threats. These parent leaders can then link up family to either city or nonprofit services such as childcare, safe transportation, and mental health counseling to overcome barriers to a child attending school. Such a method is anchored in an assumption that parents really do care about their children's future. Our parent leaders are our best partners to make sure we give our parents everything they need so our babies can get to school every single day, says Ms. Aviles-Ramos. Engaging families with care and concern, such as teachers making home visits, does make a difference. One study found that schools that scored high on family involvement before the pandemic have seen far less absenteeism. Now New York wants to step up that care and concern by enlisting neighbors who care about their neighbors. Well, we got less than a minute left. I'll read some statistics from the Numbers in the News column. 97 years, that's the estimated age of a Galapagos tortoise in the Philadelphia Zoo that became a parent this year. The tortoise, named Mommy, has had 4 hatchlings so far. And I'm not going to read any more, but these were all compiled by Nat Engelhart, who's a staff writer. Well, by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.